Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
What's up, D3 Nation? We are back, and as always, we are fired up to be in the lab here, chopping it up, talking D3 Lax. It is May 7th, and as always, in early May, the D3 landscape is shaking out. We have a tournament field that has been reduced now to 40 teams, and, you know, the home stretch, we have hit what I would call phase three of the season, phase one regular season, phase two conference championships, phase three is NCAA playoffs, and we are here to talk all about phase two and three, some conference championships and some NCAA tournament bracket reactions. It is, like we said, Wednesday, so the first round is happening today. First of those games starts this afternoon, so we have quite the slate ahead of us and a lot to get into here. As always, with me, chopping it up, chatting D3 ball, back from an Italian escapade.
Oh,
the big dog, Caleb Abden.
Dan, great to be back, man. My belly is full of salty meats and cheeses, and plenty of wine, and I'm ready to get back after it into the lacrosse world, man. Italy was great. I recommend anybody that gets the opportunity to ever travel abroad to go do it. I hate flights, and I was freaking out about this plane ride for months on end, but I did it, made it through, and it worked out well. So anybody that's scared of traveling or maybe hesitant to do so, I say take the risk, go after it. It's well worth the venture.
And one venture that you should keep in mind, a place that you should have on your radar to be attending here, is Foxborough, Massachusetts. Why would that be, Caleb?
Oh, I don't know. Is there going to be a game played there later this month?
In fact, there will be multiple played there as we hit a very important portion of the podcast here, our NCAA direction.
Ooh, love it. Hit me with it, Dan.
The men's and women's NCAA championship weekends are heading back to Gillette Stadium, held jointly for the first time since 2017. From May 23rd to May 26th, there is nowhere else in the lacrosse world to be other than Foxborough, Massachusetts for eight. You mentioned one. There's eight of them, and they're the best and most impactful games of the season. The action starts Friday with women's Division I semifinals, continues on Saturday with the men's Division I semis, then championship action starts Sunday with men's D2, men's D3, women's D1, and then Monday we get the afternoon bringing the men's Division I final. If you had to pick a pick right now, Division I champion, who's it going to be?
Division I champion? Oh,
yeah.
Tough one. Give me Maryland.
I like that pick, I guess. I don't know.
I'm Coach a D3 Tillman. Guy. Yeah.
Coach Tillman usually gets it done. I like it. We're D3 guys here. Who even cares? The real game happens Sunday night, 7 o'clock. And guess what? If you want to get into that, you want to get tickets, you want to get there, I know you do, you can get $5 off. Inside Lacrosse is proud to partner with the NCAA to offer you, our loyal listeners, $5 off of all single-day ticket options for men's and women's by using the code ILPOD at checkout. So head to ncaa.com/LaxTickets and enter ILPOD at checkout to purchase your tickets. You know you're going to championship weekend, so why not get $5 off and help us show the NCAA exactly how awesome the D3 Pod listeners are. So once again, check out ILPOD, ncaa.com/LaxTickets. Show the NCAA how awesome you and all of D3 Nation are.
Love it, Dan. You're becoming more of a professional week after week.
And you always gas me up, even if I stumble over myself. This time we've reduced the number of stumbles from like 43 down to 41. So here we are. all right, but we have a loaded episode, so let's get rolling. Conference championships, bracket reactions, and then an epic interview. Obviously, we kind of buried the lead here a little bit, not even mentioning that we have 35 minutes of reminiscing, looking back, giving some advice, and everything else that you could want from an interview with Coach Pilot. Big dog, we just wrapped that up, and now we're getting into the regular portion of recording. What's your first reaction to our chat with Coach Pilot?
Oh my God, just his knowledge of the game. He was just brilliant. You know, he's He's been around it, and learning that he's coached through five different decades is insane. Like, that spans such a massive amount of time, and I didn't want to make him feel old in the interview, like keep hounding at that, but at the same time, like, it's not that
Well,
aspect of
we
it, but
are the
the
exact
appreciation.
same age as I don't know how many children he has, probably something we could have gotten into. But we are the exact same age as Will Pilot, who is the current head coach at Immaculata and also Coach Pilot's son. So from that aspect of things, I'm sure he has at least a little bit of a realm of like, our age and generation, so to speak.
True, true. Yeah, but
That said, he goes into talking about the cameraman's father and recruiting him, and the year that he throws out, we won't tell you. We're going to make you go and listen to it. But that's the year that we were born. So there's definitely an element of, generational gap there a little bit. But as also a D3 nerd that's also a history major, that is, one of my favorite aspects of things to kind of get into is the history of D3. And he's talking about like early, really early, and he's talking about, like pre the divisional divide when it was just the four teams that go and all that type of stuff. So some really cool stuff in there. Hopefully fans enjoy that.
yeah, definitely give that a listen. It was an awesome time. Thanks so much for Coach Pilot to hop on here and be a guest. But yeah, let's get this thing moving into conference championship recap. You wanna dive into it here, Dan?
Yeah, we got a bunch of them, obviously. Too many to actually hit on every single game, but we are going to do our best to kind of spread the wealth here and talk about a handful of teams and players that really got the job done in some clutch moments.
Yep, definitely agree. And we'll get it started off here. I think the first one that was a big game, not really a shock with the result, but a shock maybe how it happened. And I'm sure a lot of people that are on Twitter or Instagram saw this overtime goal, but you had the Coastal Championship with Salisbury taking it 13-12 in overtime. Great back and forth game. Loved every second of it, but Dan, I think the one like main takeaway personally I had from this game was it the weakest overtime goal you've ever seen in your life? And not so saying that to throw shade
Like the actual goal
Salisbury.
itself.
Yeah, not throwing shade on Salisbury, not throwing shade at CNU. You
That's
know,
shade.
you battle
That's
out the
shade.
game, but I mean that was like a 5 mile an hour bouncer that just
Now
trickles in. That's devastating.
that's absolutely hater status. A freshman scores a game winner in a conference championship, and you're like, yeah, but was it a good goal?
Can you tell I'm biased against Salisbury at all? Can you tell?
And here's the thing, CNU down 7-4 at the half, and they were down 6-1 pretty early, and you kind of started thinking to yourself, gosh, like, here we go again. We're not going to really get, the game that potentially, I mean, D3 fans, every time these two teams get together, like, you're holding your breath. You think that you probably know how the result ends up, or who ends up with the W just based off of the history of it. But it's not like it would be impossible. And it's not like, we're talking about at the end of the day, it's a top two of the top five teams in the country. So, like, anything could happen. And that type of status is going to garner a ton of attention. But in the back of your head, like, who typically wins this matchup? And then that same team goes up 6-1, and you start to, like, kind of dread that you're going to sit through another 45 minutes of this. And then slowly but surely they just start chipping away, And I think CNU deserves a lot of credit to that aspect of things, that like they did the opposite of like human nature and what fans and the journalists sitting in this podcast did, which is like kind of check out once it hit that 6-1 point. And they just chipped away, chipped away, chipped away. All for that effort of the chipping away just to fall short in overtime via what you've deemed as the softest overtime goal in the history of lacrosse. It's kind of heartbreaking.
No, it really is. You battle all the way back from that just to have that. So it's
And
tough,
just to
but
like put some clarity on what we mean by battle all the way back, like they battled not just all the way back, but they took a lead. They had a lead in the fourth quarter. They're up 11-9 in the fourth quarter. Jackson Planner had a really big game against them in the first matchup, and then also had another big game against them in this one. So like they take a lead, they battle all the way back and more, and then still, the evil empire, so to speak, Big Bro, comes back. And I saw that on Twitter a couple times. We mentioned that that phrase got thrown around in the broadcast in the first matchup. And gosh, it's just, it's a hard narrative to avoid at this point.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. They seem to get the best of them just ever so slightly. But, you know, we could see this rematch in a national championship sort of form once we get to some bracket talk. So, you know, this,
you,
I think,
say we could team, because both teams are good enough to win the national championship, make it all the way through the bracket and get there. Or we could, in theory, because they're on different portions of the bracket, because those are two different statements. And I want to know where we're at. I just want to know where we're at.
I know. We'll get into it more in the bracket talk, but I'm going to say it's because they are on opposite sides. I don't think necessarily that both of those teams are going to make it to the championship, but which team isn't going to make it to the championship might surprise you.
Ooh. Something tells me there's more Salisbury hater coming later in this episode.
They get too much love, man. Someone's got to put them down.
Well, it won't be me. It will not be me. But I think that's about as much time as on each one of these games we want to spend. We got 35 minutes with Coach Pilot. We want to keep this thing to about an hour, keep people on their way. So let's go ahead. We'll move to the next one. I don't have anything too much more to add to this one. I will rapid fire a couple things, though. A ton of offensive production. You had a billion guys in the box score. And then Bryce Bromwell, like, really kind of just had another really big game, right? I think we've continued to talk about him. I think he's a known commodity at this point, so we don't have to spend too much time talking about him. But 2-2, so 4 points in that one, and that brings him to over 100 points on the season. So obviously just a really impressive year, a candidate for the player of the year, and a you know, definitely one of Division III's finest offensive players for sure.
Yep, couldn't agree more. But yep, that's a good one there. Let's keep moving on here. You want to go to the Liberty League next?
Yep, good with me. Wherever you want to take us, brother.
All right, yeah, let's go Liberty League. We had another one-goal game, not overtime, but quite close to it with RIT 11 and St. Lawrence 10. A lot of resilience, a lot of fight out of the St. Lawrence Saints there. Dan, what do you got from this one?
Yes, thank you for teeing that up. And I think, once again, similar to how I started with the loser for that Salisbury CNU one, I'll start with the loser again for St. Lawrence. And I think if we just pause for a second and close our eyes and think back to like somewhat late March after Mustang Classic, and St. Lawrence had lost to Cortland going into it. I don't think it was the game right before, but like right around the time the Mustang Classic, they had lost to Cortland. And then they come out of the Mustang Classic and they lose to Skidmore. And so you just had a team that, like, you know, most of the way through March, I don't think anybody was expecting them to end up in the Liberty League Championship. And then they just kind of turned things around. Had that really good win against Middlebury in a one-goal game, but a tight game that, you know, was a sign that things had kind of started moving in the right direction. And then they beat RPI 9-6 to close out things in the regular season. And I think a lot of people thought that that was an upset, flukes type status. Maybe not complete fluke, but, like, still upset, and, like, they wouldn't do it twice. And then they did, and not just did it twice, but they beat them almost by the same score, 9-7 the second time. So something going there where they figured out, you know, a piece of the puzzle to the RPI offense, figured out a piece of, like, the antics, I think, and, like, kind of the different unique strategies that RPI does that we've talked about on this podcast a handful of times over the years. And then they get fantastic goalie play. Someone tweeted it, and I'm going to steal it. Apologies for not remembering the credit, but, like, maybe it was Arestia. Said if Michael Marinello showed up to play against RPI every game of the season, he would be hands down the first team All-American and, like, might be a PLL candidate right now. So yeah. He continues to be, you know, at least a piece of that puzzle as well in that matchup.
Yeah, no, I think good goalie play, I mean, obviously, I'm a little biased, but good goalie play is important, and they got that for sure. So if he can show up into a big game, I think they're in any sort of game that they're playing, and that's why I drafted Michael Marinello as a big dog, you know? He's a dog. Yep.
And just to keep hammering that same point of, like, it's very similar Very similar to the game flow and kind of vibe, I would say, of that CNU Salisbury game, where both instances, it's, RIT, it's typically the dog, the top dog in that matchup against RIT and St. Lawrence, and they go up 8-3. Same thing as we were saying with Salisbury and CNU. Salisbury goes up 6-1, and in both of those instances, the other team battles, back. And St. Lawrence doesn't quite do it all the way to the same degree. They don't pull back ahead and eventually take a 2-goal lead. They don't then take a lead. They pull back to within one. But like I said, kind of the same vibe of like the team that you thought was going to lose the matchup goes down somewhat big, but never quits, continues to ramp, continues to chip at it, and then makes you believe for at least a second, like, okay, they could do it. Just to then fall for short to, the bully, so to speak, again. So, something somewhat poetic in the way that both of those games play out, but two really good games and two fun watches. And like I said, at some point during both of those games, you kind of check out and you start thinking like, we're not getting much out of this one. And then it all shifts in the second half and you do get something.
A very good battle back there. And then, so RIT side, what really what do you feel led them to this 1 point advantage here, and able to take the win here in the championship?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the biggest thing was like, I guess I'll say halftime adjustments. It's hard to know that for sure because like I feel like that's kind of a cliche thing and that people say is like if a team has a better second half than first half, then like the answer is halftime adjustments. But like I wasn't in the huddle to know that. In this instance, I feel more confident about it because they come out and they go on a 4-goal run, right? And so they hit halftime, it's tied 5-3, and RIT talks about something. Comes out, they score within the first 45 seconds of the second half, and that sparks a 4-5 goal run. And like I said, that was then leading to, said checkout point and kind of starts the game flow that we just kind of touched on. But I feel like in that moment, like, it hits it hits halftime 5-3, and we've seen some RIT lapses and dry spells. It's not super frequent, but over the years we've seen them every once in a while where someone kind of cracks a code. And so you start thinking to yourself, like, did St. Lawrence figure something out? Like, are they really on this like, upward trajectory that we just kind of mentioned going into it? And then it all kind of, comes trailing to a just a really even second half, but the difference being that opening run.
No, I agree. I think it was a well-fought battle, and honestly, it's the perfect thing RIT probably could have used before entering this tournament. They got a tough draw in their pod. They're going to have some tough games, and you don't want to be kind of cakewalking through things, which we'll talk about toughs here in the NESCAC a little bit, which isn't their fault. You can only play who you can play, but I would say as a coach, you'd much rather an 11-10 close game where your kids have to grind out a tough win versus maybe, just smacking everybody that you're walking through. So, end of the day, I think it's going to be a good thing for RIT, and I think they're going to come into the tournament really battle tested and ready to play.
Yeah, agreed. And they're still RIT at the end of the day. There's just something about them. They do what they do better than other teams do what they do. And when your, identity is just so strongly ingrained in success, it's hard to pick against them or think that they're not going to be successful in the tournament, regardless of their draw.
Agreed. Anything else from this game, or you want to go to the Centennial?
No, I think I'll leave it at that. The only other thing I'll say, and we've talked about St. Lawrence a little bit, but I think this is worth hitting on pod. We talked a bit about it on social, and it kind of made the rounds a little bit there. But Dan Anderson for St. Lawrence, a funny story, or I mean, I don't know if funny is the right word, but kind of a crazy story, as he was at Denver, transferred, played basketball, transferred to play basketball, wasn't intending to play lacrosse. Didn't play lacrosse until about like halfway through the season. It might have been post Mustang Classic, actually, still. Actually, it was definitely post Mustang Classic. So, like mid to late March, he joins the team, picks the stick back up, and then has 3 points in the conference championship, has 2 goals and an assist. And it is just one of their, more reliable players. And, even in the championship game, he has a goal in the fourth quarter and He's just a really athletic and just an incredible piece to kind of get to add to your roster that you weren't expecting to be able to add to your roster halfway through the season.
Yeah. Yeah. Huge, huge, huge addition for them. And I think it's one that's going to poise them to make a good little tournament run here. So we'll dive into that, but we'll keep things moving here into the Centennial Championship, which we saw my Dickinson Red Devils, Final Four team, win their fourth straight Centennial Conference Championship, beating Gettysburg 13-11. This one was kind of surprising for me. You asked me a month ago who has this game. I probably don't even say Dickinson's in this game. So the fact they make it to this and then they beat a very good Gettysburg team is a good feat for them. So Dan, what'd you see in this game?
Yeah, I got to catch a lot of this one. I got to catch a lot of the Sunday matchups. Saturday matchups, I was on the move a little bit for, which is, was a fantastic time, and we'll touch on that a little bit. But I definitely got to digest a lot of these Sunday matchups, and I really think, again, it just comes down to a second half comeback, or a second half, I guess I'll say run. But in this instance, it was backs against the wall and you needed it, versus a team that did it to strengthen a lead or distance a lead, so to speak, the first two games. And here you had Dickinson down, right? Down 9-7 and kind of struggling to score. They had a pretty long drive spell during that game. And then Landon Hyatt, who currently leads the team in points, goes back to back, ties the game up. And then from there, you kind of had a little bit more swagger and momentum and confidence and everything that comes with that defensively, or excuse me, offensively for Dickinson. And then a really interesting note in this one was Gettysburg late in the game goes to a double with no goalie in really early. And it definitely impacted the game flow. I'm all for aggressive decisions, but I felt like that was just a bit early to go to that. It's just a little too desperate too early with shot clocks.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely, I can't fault that there. I mean, I like the aggressive play though. I see where they're coming from with it, and you got to get the rock back. You probably think that's your strong suit of your team. You have great pulls that are rangy, can take the ball away, get it back to your offense. So I see the decision-making process. I see where it was all at, but end of the day, having hindsight 2022, being able to look back at it and know the result, saying,
was totally maybe a lot easier for us to say now on a podcast on Tuesday night that they shouldn't have done something, knowing that the result of it,
Exactly. But yeah, in the moment, definitely, I would say
part of the reason I say that though is just face offs, right? So you weren't gonna get the ball. You weren't gonna get the ball. I guess maybe that's reason to do it, because you weren't gonna get the ball any other way besides by doubling. Except you were though, because you were still gonna get shot clock violations.
Yeah, yeah, you still had the clock working on your time, I think. And
right,
you know,
so that kind of goes contradictory to what you're saying, because they weren't winning faceoffs. So by doubling in that situation, you're letting the goal out, pulling the goalie out. Now Dickinson scores, and they're gonna win the next faceoff. So yeah. You would have been better off relying on a shot clock violation than anything else, or working for it.
Or keeping the goalie in and trying to double too, leaving the backside all the way open. Or
yeah, I guess. But something. That ain't working.
No.
I can tell you that now.
You don't think my defense would work in the D3 championship?
Double the ball with the goalie in? No.
Yeah. something the Swarm has been known to do.
Nope. Nope, nope, nope. That ain't winning no conference championship. Sorry, buddy. But Ben Truxas goes 16 of 25, 10 ground balls. Just a huge day at the X. And like we said, it was a huge part of the success there. And we've mentioned that a lot. Every time we've talked about Gettysburg this season, it's I think they have a lot of pieces. You mentioned it. You rangy, aggressive, long pulls that can put the ball on the ground, pretty athletic, have good sticks, are good in transition, offensively pretty skilled, pretty slick. Top 6 guys can really move the ball. Top 9 guys really, they go pretty deep. But like very flawed facing off. And how much does any of the first bit of what I talked about really matter if you're going to be, you know, that far behind at the faceoff X? I don't know. You're going to have to find some ways to make up for possessions, and late in the year against good teams, that gets harder and harder to do.
Yep. Yep. Couldn't agree more. So we'll see. We'll see how things play out though. I think Dickinson has some good pieces though. They're getting hot at the right time. You know, they got the faceoff working very well for them, kind of starting to flow on offense. They go through those dry spells a little bit, like you said, which is a bit concerning, but you know, I think they've positioned themselves quite well here for the tournament. So looking forward to that.
All right, let's keep it moving. Yep, both teams in the tournament. That was a situation going into it where both teams knew no matter what happened, both teams were in. So, I mean, perhaps Dickinson could have convinced themselves that it wasn't a clear path, but NPI Dan knew or knows that it was. So,
yeah.
Whether Coach Webby had let the team in on that or not was a Coach Webby decision, but I think we knew all along, no matter what, the loser of that one was in either way.
Yeah, they would both be in there. Yep, so talking about two other teams that also both got in, we'll go to the ODAC Championship, where we had, another one-goal game. These games were incredible. So you had Washington and Lee with 13 and Lynchburg 12. This is the second time in 3 years that Washington and Lee has won the ODAC title, and we talked about it with Coach Pilot, but ODAC, one of, you know, the most historic great conferences. So the fact of win that 2 out of 3 years is very, very impressive. Shows that they got a pretty deep team with a good roster. But Dan, talk about this game a little bit and how WNL just barely edged it out.
Really tight. Again, like you mentioned, just super, super hard fought. WNL has a 6-goal first quarter. They go up 6-3. So a ton of goals to start the game. And then things kind of just like tail off. Again, we're kind of burying the lead because it was such an incredible game-winning goal. It was the opposite of the Salisbury goal that you mentioned, where it was a short stick D-mid scoring on like a backhand goal, and has his back to the cage as he catches it. It's just a pretty crazy finish and goal in general.
Yeah, that goal was awesome goal.
Totally. And we mentioned, you know, like big-time players and big-time games make big-time performances, whatever that expression is. And Tyler Spano was huge again. Consistently has been one of the most important pieces of every WNL game. And in this instance, he goes 15 of 26. I think he has a goal, and he had 14 ground balls. So just a crazy, impact over the course of 60 minutes from Spano. And then defensively, you had Jay O'Keefe had a milestone-type game, 7 calls turnovers, 6 ground balls. Just creating a ton of chaos and, some really big plays as well.
Any relation to Mac?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of.
That would be cool, though. I'm all into the relationships these days. I mistook Joe Perry's brother for his cousin when his cousin got picked up by the Ravens. I was super pumped.
How did you even know that they were related at all, though?
Well, so I follow Joe Perry because he's the freaking man on Instagram, and he was tweeting about his – I thought it was his brother at the
time.
You
assumed brother, but it was just that he was tweeting about him vaguely.
Yeah, and it was more –
and you were like, that must be his brother.
I saw same last name, looked similar to him. I was like, oh, must be his brother. Cousin. Cousin's pretty darn close, though. At the end of the day, I have a cousin that I treat like my brother, so – you know, could be that sort of aspect. We got to talk about the Spartans yet. Do you want to touch just briefly on the NESCAC? I know the championship game was pretty much a wash with Tufts 22, Wesleyan 10, but the semifinal before that with Wesleyan 9, Bowdoin 8 was an incredible game. Obviously you gotta give a shout out to the Wesleyan there for pulling it out against a Bowdoin team that's been really good all year. So for them to pull that out in the semis and make it to the championship, great stuff. But then, you know, as I'd say most people assume, Tufts kept rolling there and gets the win 22-10. So back to the NESCAC champs for the Jumbos. But yes, let's keep it moving to the last one, Mac, with the Mac Commonwealth, York 16, Stevenson 10. A lot of fun. Dan, I know you were boots on the ground for this one, so please Tell me all about it.
I did. I did get there. I had boots on the ground. I'll add a couple things to your NESCAC recap real quick. Just adding a little context that the Wesleyan win over Bowdoin was actually in the just played not too long ago, maybe 2 weeks or so before, kind of that mid-April range. Wesleyan had lost to Bowdoin 14-10 in that first matchup. Goes home, does the work to refigure out what's going on. Comes back, picks up a 9-8 win, and obviously lower scoring than I think anybody would have really guessed or had imagined in that one. And a big piece of that is Connor Selfridge in goal for the Cards. 16 saves around that like plus 65% mark. So really impressive stuff there. And
that's team on your back though status. That's Greg Jennings' team on your back though.
Yes, congratulations to Connor Selfridge for officially reaching that Greg Jennings status, courtesy of the big dog. And then, yeah, like you said, it's such a hard format. Hopefully this is something that, like, if you're a Cardinals fan, you can see them taking a lesson from in this NESCAC situation where it's Saturday, Sunday, back-to-back semis and championship. You got the same thing coming down the pipe here for NCAA tournament in terms of back-to-back. And it felt like there was a little bit of like the emotional drop off, right? So like on Saturday you have Bowdoin, one goal game, super tight all the way through. You beat a team that had beaten you in the regular season, and you know going into those types of weeks, that's typically who you spend your like prep time on, it's who you spend your scout time on. And it's not like Wesleyan, when specifically like anybody really, it's not like when you get to this point and you're into the conference championship side of things, you're not unfamiliar with the teams you're going to be playing. But even still, like the extra reminders, the focus on the team, so on and so forth through that week leads you to typically like, you know, a better level of attention to detail about the first opponent. And then you figure out the second opponent, you know, and you kind of do the work basically overnight to get your team ready. And that entails like, you know, resting that night in the hotel, getting your rehab, getting your good meals, and doing that while you're schooling the guys up. And then same thing goes in the morning, right? School the guys up while you get them breakfast, get them recovery, get them hydrated, all that type of stuff. And it's hard, right? And so if you have a game that you know, have that like super emotional high on one day, it can be tough to flip the script. And I feel like that was a little bit of what we saw there with that Tufts Wesleyan game. And so at this point, like if you're Tufts, you roll out the same game plan, right? Like control C, control V for the back-to-back. But if you are Wesleyan, like maybe you take a few things of what you learned from this weekend when day two didn't go so well and see how you can change some things, manipulate a little bit of the schedule, figure it out so that maybe you have a little bit more of an emotional edge on that day two.
Yeah. That's a good call. And if I know Coach Rabba, good coach, he's gonna have the boys ready. He's gonna figure that out. So
now for the boots on the ground. I did have boots on the ground for the Spartan Sunday game against Stevenson. Really enjoyed myself from the fan uncle alumni perspective. Didn't do much in terms of the coverage. We just kind of went up with you know, my wife and kids, and we kid child, and got a good meal, went to some local spots, a couple beverages, watched the game, hung out with my brother, all that type of stuff. So, yeah, had a good time from that perspective of things. From the lacrosse side of things, it was nice. All around, I think it was really nice of the Spartans to reduce the edge and relieve my nerves. They go up 8-1 by the end of the first quarter. And so it felt like after, you know, the first 15-minute frame, you kind of knew where things were going. You had to hope and there wasn't going to be some sort of epic choke, but based on the way that the first quarter went, it was like, you know, lots of everybody was feeling themselves. It was lots of good vibes there for that. A large part of that goes to Gavin Gismondi, who this has to be some sort of record, be it like conference record, York record, NCAA record. I don't know, but points in a quarter, he had 6, 3 goals, 3 assists. And like I said, it ends 8-1 at that point. And so there wasn't a whole ton more to the rest of the game at that point. It was just like, you know, ride it out, play smart, be disciplined, and make winning plays, and you're going to end up, you know, conference champs.
Yeah, I was just about to text coach at the end of the first quarter and say drop another 20 burger on him, but, you know, I didn't want to be the reason the jinx happened and then the comeback and everything, so I withheld that, and it was It was the smart play by me. But yeah, York dominated this whole game. It was, as an alumni, it was great to see. You know, it was good to see another conference championship back with the boys. And I think it set them up good for a nice little tournament pod seeding playoff berth type situation.
100%. And this was another one where we knew going into it that both teams were in no matter what, right? Like, yeah. I don't know that played a real impact on anything, as both teams obviously want to, you know, be crowned conference champ. And Stevenson was the conference champ in 2024, so they had the defending of the title to do. York didn't make it to the conference championship after losing to Eastern, so they had some what do you want to call that? Revenge? Revenge to seek.
Yeah,
to
chip on their, to get chip the trophy, on their shoulder.
You chip on the shoulder to get to have the trophy returned to the rightful residence, I should say. And so, yeah, like I said, a good time from the boots on the ground perspective. Enjoyed that. Enjoyed seeing some friendly faces. And there's still like a residual of some of the kids that I recruited there, whether it's like their younger brother or, you know, like there's still some of that. So, or they just go back, like, and now they're alums. So that's cool too. So, yeah, boots on the ground, had a good time. Spartans win. Gavin Gizmondi goes 3-3 in the first quarter.
Awesome stuff.
That's all I got.
Yep. well, it sounds like a great day. Very jealous of that day. Wish I could have been there. But sounds wonderful.
Honestly, you should be.
I definitely do. I was at a little jet lagged. I was at a engagement party that day, so I had the phone up the whole time. Like, yay, congratulations, phone up, right on the game.
The back and forth, I love it. I've been there many times.
Yeah,
been there plenty. We talked about this on text, but this is like the best time of year in terms of like I don't have to do anything like that. Like nobody would ever think that on a Saturday or Sunday that I'm going to do something like that. Like,
yeah.
They might invite me, but I have like full range to just be like, no. Like,
yeah.
We'll be watching ball. Sorry.
Yeah. Good. Well, you want to get into this tournament
bracket? Yeah, let's do some bracket reactions, bracket talks, some matchups, some paths, so on and so forth. Let's take a quick break real quick, and then we'll come back and do it. All right. Stick with us, D3 Nation. I know we're going a little long here, but we have an awesome segment here after this with Coach Pilot. 35 minutes of reminiscing on 37 years of service there for the Roanoke Maroons at the helm. And we really thank him for coming on. We thought that that's a fun conversation. We hope everybody enjoys it. So stick around. And before we get into that, we're going to do some bracket talk, some reactions, best paths, worst draws, matchups and rematchups that we're excited for. Yeah, let's get into it. What was your first initial reaction upon seeing the actual 40-team field?
Oh man, I was jazzed up. You know, I got that. Let me just quickly preface this with, you know, all the other conferences. Actually, I don't know what happened to D2, but D1, they get that nice live show with all the clips. Looks super cool. D3, it's a pre-recorded thing, so. You know the big dogs just skipping through to look through all the pods real quick. I got all the pods within.
I don't even know how you did that. I don't even know how you fast forwarded through it.
Dude, I was just on the iPhone. I just click, and it would just take me to the next pod.
Oh.
Yeah, it was just pod after pod, and I was just like, well.
I was on a laptop, and it didn't have like a fast forward bar or anything.
Oh.
And I couldn't click on it, so like.
No,
I was just in for the long haul.
Yeah, that the iPhone does it good. But, I mean, good show by the NCAA. Really like it. But in the future, I think I'd appreciate, you know.
You want it to be live. You want live.
A 10-minute live show. Is that too hard to ask? I don't know.
Probably.
Probably is too much to ask. But, hey, we'd even do it. We'd be out there doing it if they needed us to. So, you know, just a little.
We would suck at that. You would read one of the team's names wrong.
Oh, I would at least three of the teams, minimum. Over under would be 3.5 for how many teams I mess up.
And welcome to the tournament, Fermingdale State. Trinity.
but initial thoughts of the bracket. I don't want to ruin all of our segments here, so I'm not going to go into my nitpicky things here and there. Overall, though, I think it was a great bracket. You know, they got the two best teams on either side, so very good chance they could meet for the championship. I think there's some poised upsets that are within there. You got some teams that don't really play each other too much, so I think that's going to be a lot of fun. And York gets a great draw. So all in all, beautiful bracket, if you ask me.
The fan appeal in you, the York fan appeal in you, the greater D3 fan appeal in you. Everything was checked.
Yep. Check, check, check. I guess the committee did well with the help of the MPI, whatever you want to call that there.
All right. Should we talk about that at all? I feel like we probably have to because there's been enough like
kickback, blowback.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have to.
Social media chatter.
Yep. So set it right for the people, Dan. Tell us.
Well, there's nothing to set right. There's just no arguing. This is what annoys me about it. Is there's no, like, there's nothing to argue. Like, I don't know why you can't argue anything. It's a computer. Like, yeah. People would be like, people that are using words like deserve or resume, like, based on what? Based on what? There's nothing. There is no resume. It's just what the computer says. The computer, yeah. What the number spits out is your resume. So, yeah. Like, there's nothing to argue, which that's what has me worked out. That combined with the fact that, like, what's gone extinct out of this is the, like, reaction live time. Like, screw NCAA live show reaction. Give us the live reaction of any classrooms.
Yeah.
Because, like, everybody knows the field. You know the field before the tournament show even came out. All that was a bracket reveal.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, you're getting matchups, but it wasn't a reveal of the field. We knew that. I don't know what time I tweeted the tweet with the updated NPI, but like we knew the field.
Oh yeah. It was well before the bracket was released.
The last game, there was a 3 PM conference championship game. That game ended at 5:00. So at 5:02, like we knew the field of, we knew the field at that point. Even before that, we did pretty much.
And the only big question mark was Williams if they could get in with a losing record. And sure
enough, the only reason that was a question is because idiots like you and me go on podcasts and say things that are wrong.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Couldn't agree more. Yeah.
Like if you go back right now, if you're a fan listening to this for the first time because you got so worked up about NPI and you don't really know what's going on, go back and listen to the first episode of this. We like give a much more thorough explanation of what it all is, how it works, why is it in existence, so on and so forth. So like go back. That's your best bet to figure things out. But even in those episodes, we were talking about things like what happens if Williams, like if the tournament ended today, Williams would be less than 500, but within a spot to fill an at-large threshold. And it was like, guess they're out.
Yeah.
Why did we think that? I don't know. Because of prior thought that like you should have an at-large. Plus the fact that on a NESCAC specific, it's called CACLAX. Shout out to CACLAX. They had Will Hopkins on and talked about Will Hopkins, the chair of the committee, and talked about that exact thing. They asked him and he said, when it comes to at-large resumes, you're still going to need to be above 500. So, like, I'll also stop right here for a second and say that if my team was on the wrong side of that statement, I would be furious also. But, like, it's not like that was – there's no rule book saying that when people go on a podcast, if they're wrong or say something, like, I don't know. Like, he's just – Does it suck that he went on the podcast and said that and it wasn't true? Yes. But, like, does that mean that the committee got the group wrong? No.
Yeah.
Like, they picked the 25 teams or, excuse me, the 40 teams that they were told to pick by virtue of having 27 AQs and then picking the next top 13 NPI teams. And that was what was written. That was what was stated. That was what was going to be the case. And then these extracurricular qualifying factors were just like imposed by like hypothetical situations that weren't real.
Yeah.
Like they don't matter.
Yep, agreed. And yeah, if there was any repercussions for not saying correct things on podcasts, this podcast would not be a podcast a long time ago. Yeah.
I almost tweeted that exact thing. I had it teed up in drafts and I decided not to send it. But I was just going to quote tweet it and say, if being wrong on a podcast is illegal, at C. Abney is serving multiple life sentences.
Multiple. I would never see the light of day.
I'd probably be in a jail cell next to you serving some amount of time, but I like am not on life sentence yet.
I would be like, dude, yeah, I'm here for the long haul. I'll teach you the ropes.
So what do they got you in for? Yeah, I was wrong with the podcast.
Really wrong. So I think that's a good little MPI discussion, though. So let's go into the best pass. I'm biased. I'm obviously going to say, alluded to it earlier, but York, great path for them. You know, they
is it biased to say that your team got the best path or the hardest path? I think it's opposite. I think you're being not biased by saying that.
Really? You think by saying they got the easiest path, it's a little less biased?
Yeah, I don't think there's any bias to it. I mean, okay. I don't know.
I don't know.
So I think it would be more biased to say that my team has the hardest path.
Oh, okay. My team worked the hardest, is going to work the hardest to get where they're going. And okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Then, yeah. Then more power to York at this point, because I love the pool that they got. They're going to play the winner of Trinity Farmingdale, and then they got the winner of Cortland and Wesleyan, Illinois Wesleyan, that is. So let's keep moving and get to worst draw. Who do you think kind of got shafted here?
CNU.
Yep. Yep. Definitely would agree with that. You got to go through Grove City, taking you to overtime, maybe Gettysburg, maybe Lynchburg, both very solid teams. Get through that just to get to Bowdoin, you know?
I think you got a little bit confused there, and I'm going to help you out. Okay. Yes, they're going to have to most likely deal with Grove City. Grove City probably walks through Albion. Not going to, you know. I won't say that it's a guarantee. I won't do it. But I'm pretty confident Grove City rolls through Albion, and then they get CNU. But then what we're looking at here is CNU, assuming that they beat Grove City, which isn't a foregone conclusion as a game that went to overtime earlier in the year.
I see my mistake. I put Berg for Lynchburg.
Yes, there you go. There you go. You got it. Then you have the winner of Lynchburg and Stevenson takes on CNU. And so CNU at fourth in NPI at fourth in the country, had an amazing season, gets gifted the winner of Stevenson and Lynchburg, and that is spicy. Both of those teams have played in national championships. Stevenson has a national championship. Lynchburg's been there. They're tough. They're athletic. It's a day two matchup for CNU if you're not like 100% rested, and one of those, like, you know, it's just that I think that they have, that's a tough draw. That's a really tough draw.
Yep, agreed. And if you get through all that, you're most likely seeing Bowdoin at the end of that, which is no easy task.
And I saw something down there in that stretch. Like, I think Bowdoin makes it out. I think that the Amherst team that Bowdoin played, you know, a while back is a little different. But, Amherst beat Bowdoin in the regular season. And everybody right now is kind of assuming Bowdoin's going to roll through their portion of that pod. And the Mammoths have been resting. They've been eating. They've been hibernating. And they have been sharpening their tusks. And we're going to get a Mammoth versus Polar Bear fight that I don't know.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah, good. Good analysis. I think that they're all going to be – once we get to the Elite Eight, I think everything's going to be
– No doubt. No doubt. Electric. And I think that is one of the things that this bracket has done really well. Is if you think of it from like Tufts 1, Salisbury 2, CNU 3, RIT 4, or excuse me, RIT 3, CNU 4. So then it's like, assuming that those four advance, then it would be Tufts 1, CNU 4, Salisbury 2, RIT 3 in the final four, right? If that continues to be the case. Okay, so like take those four. And then if you expand that, and now you look at it as York, Bowdoin, Wesleyan, W&L, and that becomes like, you know, your 4 through 8 seeds. If you think of it from that perspective of things, I think that this bracket is like really, really well balanced.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's well said. Couldn't agree more there. Let's see. What is one of the spicy rematches you think we're going to see? And it could be a potential spicy rematch. So like a second or third round matchup that could potentially happen. It doesn't need to be already set in stone, but what's one potential rematch you see that's going to be a lot of fun?
Yeah, hold that right there. It's a good question, and I'm definitely want to hit it, but I just want to hammer home the point. NPI in the point that NPI serves in all of what we just explained with the seeding, right? And so Tufts through WNL are the eight that we just listed out. Like, that is also directly in accordance with the NPI. And then you also have today, you have eight first round games, right? So 16 teams playing. And the 16 teams that make that up are teams that fall 25 through 40 in the NPI. And then once you have the like established seeding, you know, then obviously there's teams that fall in between. And all of that, like once you have the established seeding for those eight hosts and top seeds, and then the 16 that are going to be in the first round, and then the teams that are left in the middle, it just becomes about like matching it based off of geography. And so from that perspective, it's like NPI has eliminated a bunch of the confusion, both on seeding and on the actual field of selection. And so like it's just made for a ton of clarity. And I guess like you could argue that NPI isn't the best metric, and that's like a whole nother can of worms. But like from the effect that it has on creating a combination of like transparency around field selection and clarity on seeding, like there's very little arguing that there is even room for.
Yeah. Yeah, no. But again, we talked about it offline a little bit, but you alluded to it earlier, but half the battle or half the fun of all this is, you know, talking to your buddy about who should have made it.
Half the fun from fan perspective, for sure.
Yeah,
NCAA D3, like, administrators don't give a f*** about that.
Yeah.
True. They care a lot more about the first thing that I said, which is, like, a system of transparency and clarity that allows them to create the selection, allows them to create seedings. And from their perspective, they can take the same thing and apply it across all team sports. So, yeah. Like, again, like the lacrosse fan in me doesn't love it. The lacrosse bracketologist definitely doesn't love it. But the like sensical side of somebody, and like, you know, the thing that actually pays the bills that like provide for my family is summer events tournaments and like running those. So like as somebody that does that essentially for a living, like I definitely understand the advantage that having a system that you can just lean on provides.
Yeah. No, well said. Good. You ready to go into rematches now?
Yes, and excuse me for the language, but we're officially in the D3 after dark territory.
Yeah, we've crossed over 11 p.m., which is D3 after dark. Good. I'm going to go in with rematches, though. I'm going to give you a spicy one. It's one that is in the third round, I believe. Second or third round? I think it's third round. But I think we're going to see a Gettysburg WNL rematch, which should be a blast. Yeah, that's a rematch, right? It is getting after dark now, so.
Gettysburg beat them early in the season, or early-ish.
Yep, Gettysburg beats them early on. WNL obviously coming on strong, though, with Gettysburg, you know, faltering in the championship there. So I think this is going to be a lot of fun. My personal bracket, I have WNL taking it, but I think it's going to be a pretty big toss-up.
If I had to pick one, I'm picking St. Lawrence and Middlebury. It was an awesome game, a one-goal game. I thought it was a really important game. We actually kind of touched on this earlier in the podcast. A really important game for St. Lawrence. And then Middlebury, you get an opportunity to kind of, you know, beat a team that beat you by one in the regular season, a team that you get to enter the matchup with some familiarity on. So I really like that one. Two teams that we would have ranked, so to speak. I think the obvious one is Stevenson-Lynchburg, like we said. Two teams that, like, there's no other matchups in this among teams that have both either won or played in a national championship as an opening matchup of the NCAA tournament for those teams. So, I don't think. I might be technically wrong somehow, but like that's just a heavyweight matchup when it comes to, you know, early season stuff, and they played early in the year in a game that Stevenson took pretty handily.
Yeah, Agreed. Yeah. If I had to add just one more there, we touched on it too, but the Grove City Christopher Newport rematch, I think that's going to be a lot of fun if it comes down to that. And Christopher Newport looking to kind of avenge that early season. I wouldn't say it's not a loss, but you know, that early season tight game there, and show that they do have the dominance. But when you got a Danny Stone, anything can happen. You know, that's what I love about Grove City.
And then RPI and Williams, that's a rematch. Williams took that 14-9 the first time. Excuse me, RPI took that 14-9 in the first matchup. And so now you have this element of like, nobody really thinks that Williams should have been in the tournament because they were less than 500. But now they get in and they have the opportunity to prove that they belonged against a really good team. And I think that that like narrative and element is pretty fun. And so, yeah, I think you nailed it. A lot of potential for some spicy rematches, and also some intriguing matchups that we don't typically get, which feels like a good segue. What's one that you would highlight there?
Let's see. That's going to be a fun one. Going through the list here, Trinity York jumps out in my mind right away. I don't think they've ever played each other. You know, York playing NESCAC teams is a lot of fun. We don't see it too often, but Trinity specifically, I feel like, is one you don't see pretty much ever, York Trinity. So I think that's going to be the one that stands out for me.
You know, no, what's interesting?
Hit me.
I think if I had to put a team on upset alert for this first day, it might be Trinity and Farmingdale State.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a long shot. It is at
Farmingdale State, isn't it?
It is at Farmingdale State, so they get the benefit of being the lower seed but hosting. Not sure why. There's a variety of reasons that it could be. I know that in theory it's supposed to go to the higher NPI team. The other seven matchups, the higher team in the NPI is the host. And then, like we said, geography kind of goes into making those actual matchups, and then NPI helps sculpt them and helps create hosts and so on and so forth. But that's one that like I just could see it going the opposite way. And, yeah, like I said, if we had to pick one, I could see that. The other one that I would throw out at you would be WestCon over Babson. Babson lost a Coast Guard late in the year. WestCon can sneak up on you, usually has some sneaky players. And I think Babson obviously goes in as the favorite. So like if they do win, nobody's going to be, you know, surprised by any means. But like I said, gun to my head, you want me to pick a couple of potential upsets for the first round, that's where I would go. And then if you are, what led us down this tangent was the discussion of like somewhat unique matchups that we aren't used to seeing, that could be pretty dang good. I don't know that I'm used to seeing Ohio Wesleyan and St. John Fisher go at it. It's one that just like looking at it, I can't recall ever seeing off the top of my head or anything like that. I'd be curious what the actual history has to say about it. But I feel like that's one that, you know, two teams that have been floating in the like between 15 and 25, 15 and 30 range all season. So relatively close to each other in terms of like that aspect of things. But I can't really recall them playing each other too much. So I'd highlight that one as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and if we want to talk quickly just potential matchups, an Elite Eight matchup of CNU-Bowdoin. That's going to be a lot of fun if we get that. Or CNU Amherst, either of those teams. Those are two matchups you don't see very often at all. So potentially a good one there in the Elite Eight round.
Agreed. And honestly, like you said, at that point, once you get to the final eight teams within Division III lacrosse, you're just – it's bangers everywhere. Also, the math is in. I just looked it up. St. John Fisher, Owoo, they've played one time. 2012, your boy's senior year of high school, and that was a 10-5 Ohio Wesleyan victory. So, one time, that is officially what we will consider a rare matchup.
Yep, I would have to agree.
All right, let's land this plane. What else do you have here? It's been a loaded week. We had conference championships. We have to get to the Coach Pilot interview here in a few minutes. And obviously just a really fun time to be a D3 fan. Conference championships put you through the ringer. And then just as soon as you get out of that wave pool, you get thrown right into the NCAA tournament, starting on the Wednesday of it, leading you into the weekend that then has you hitting right into back-to-backs. and it just kind of rolls from here. We're going to blink and Memorial Day weekend will be here. We'll be on Sunday, national championship, like countdown watch. And yeah, the next little bit is going to be, it's going to fly by.
It's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. Dan, if I have to shout out just a couple things here, I do this office, I do print out this bracket, give it to everybody in my office. We all do a little bracket and it's really fun. Cause most of the other guys, you know, they don't know too much about
yeah,
the team.
It's just picking off vibes.
Exactly. That. Yeah. And they,
I might make this a requirement. We're in the process of like doing our intern onboarding for the summer. I might send a digital bracket to the interns and make them fill it out.
Just make them fill out a bracket, see who's got the best vibes in that.
Yes, that's, exactly. Anybody who doesn't pick York is fired.
Immediately. So, yeah, they always ask, like, oh, who's my champion? And, like, last year my buddy picked, like, W&L. I'm like, oh, Hillis Burns, like, that's your guy. Like, go stand on a up on a hill.
Like, yeah, I've been a Hillis Burns fan since day one, dude.
I love Hillis. Like, he's my guy. So I do have to give a shout out to Mike Estes, who won last year. Great dude.
Shout out, Mike.
Yep. He picked the RIT Tufts championship with Tufts winning it all. So good call there. So he submitted his bracket today. His final four is Tufts, Salisbury, RIT, and get this, Endicott for his top four. So little out there for old Mike, but I think he's
smoking peyote.
Could be.
Under Armour, drug test your employees.
Yeah. careful. he deserves a little shout out there, but it's gonna be fun this year. You know, we got everyone submitting their brackets. I threw my stuff out there, you know, I made a vibes bracket, threw a picture out there of it.
I love that.
Yep. And you know,
brackets should be picked from the heart, not the brain.
Yeah, exactly. If I made a true bracket, like through like thinking about it, knowing all the things that I know, like probably would be a little bit more cut and dry, but I had a little bit of fun with it. So if you want to check out my bracket, go on to Twitter. I included a picture of the sickest fish I've ever caught in the picture of the bracket.
I noticed that. It's not a big enough fish. It's not a big enough fish for bounce back status.
Dude, you know how big my hands are?
It's not.
Oh, it was a big old bass, man.
Dude. All right.
Trust me. If you want to see this bass, go to Twitter, check it out.
It's not a big enough bass for a mouse pad stat. It was one of my biggest reactions to the whole thing. Yeah. I was like, oh, he's got a bracket. Oh, some hot takes. Whoa, that fish is not big enough. But a cool themed mouse.
Mouse pad.
Mixed up.
Yeah.
No. Oh, the actual mouse.
My clone trooper mouse.
The mouse, yeah. The actual mouse is enough pro points to make up for the minus points on the fact that you have a mouse print out of a fish that is like 4 inches big.
Man, fair criticism, although I will die on the hill that fish was huge. So
it's not by any means. Like, this is the same argument about the teams that should have got in, deserving of being called big by what standards?
My hands, they're huge.
Not the criteria.
Oh man, I love bracket season.
All right, that's a good note to end on. A really good note to end on. I think people will like that. I know I do. We really appreciate everybody who tunes in. We hope that if you like what you heard, you can do us a solid, send it to a friend, rate, review, all that good stuff. Head to social media, find us on Twitter. I'm at dkaplan46.
At CAbney02.
Let us know what you think. Send us some thoughts. And like we said, we really appreciate everybody who takes some time to tune in.
Yep, really appreciate it. And now, Coach Pilot.
We have a really special guest on, a legend of the game. We're thrilled to have on Coach Pilot. As we stated, a 413 and 187 record over 37 years. He's the fourth winningest active coach. 10 ODAC titles, 14 NCAA tournament appearances, 4 Final Fours, 11 ODAC Coaches of the Year, 114 All-Americans, and I could keep listing accolades if I really wanted to. And like we said, we are thrilled to have you on. Coach, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you guys. Great to be here. Anytime it's Division III lacrosse, I love it. So thanks for doing what you guys do.
Absolutely. And we were thrilled to find out that you were at least a little bit familiar with what we do. And we really appreciate Will for helping fill the conversation. I told him, I made the joke that he was like your agent all week. I was talking to him. So that was a pretty funny aspect. And he's got a busy week ahead of him. How much have you talked to him about their matchup?
Yeah, no, I talked to him a bunch. I got to be up there for his conference championship and watch his team win. I seen him play a couple times and that was really exciting, and he's done a great job with that team, and they are they got some great players, so I really like watching them play, and they really play hard, so I'm excited for him for sure.
And he's got a really interesting matchup also with one of the guys from your coach tree, who also is one of our connections to Roanoke as well through Coach Hall. So that's Immaculata and Scranton for anybody who's listening and, you know, trying to piece together the pieces here. But yeah, interesting perspective how, you know, your hands touch all aspects of that matchup.
Yeah, it's great. You know, Coach Hoffmeister at Scranton's done a great job with that team. I mean, starting out 0-8, and then he's been on a run and he's got a great team. But I think Immaculata and Coach Will Pilot takes him tomorrow. So we'll see.
I love it. I'm with you. I think Coach Pilot's got a little bump going with him, and everyone knows that the D3 pod brings a little bump as well. So hopefully that fuels a little bit of magic. But Big Dog, I know you have a few questions teed up here for us. Why don't you kick us off with the first one?
Yeah, Coach, I'm going to give you an easy one to start off here, trying to get us into the interview here. So my wife, actually a graduate from Roanoke, 2017, I believe. Yep. But she wanted me to ask you, Mac and Bob's or McAdoo's?
Mac and Bob's for dinner and for hanging out. McAdoo's for sandwiches.
Okay. That's a good answer. And do you have a go-to calzone at Mac and Bob's?
You know, everybody likes the Boston zone, but I just like the Kendall zone myself. A little smaller, less calories, but both are awesome.
Okay. Ooh, good answer. Yeah, I've been a buff zone guy myself. Pretty good, but yes, very filling. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, good. Yep, love that. And all then, right. Yeah, get in there, Dan.
I was gonna say, I know you love to serve up the softball to start. I'm the complete opposite. I love to come and I like to throw the heavy hitter to get you going. And one of the things that obviously I think everybody is excited to tune in for, and we're excited to have you on for, is just to do some reminiscing. Right, 37 seasons. You had to have coached some great players, had to have coached some awesome teams, had to have coached some, you know, really just thrilling moments and seen it all, right? And so as you kind of reminisce back on it and, you know, think about the 37 seasons that was your tenure there, what are some of the moments that you think, like, you'll just will never escape you?
Well, you know, I was walking the dog before I came on your show, and I was thinking about some stuff, and you know, the great thing for me is, you know, when I started as head coach in 1989, you know, in Division III, Hobart was still running Division III, right? So that's why I had to go against those guys. And then I saw their reign start to dwindle with Salisbury, right? So in the 1992 national championship, we played Nazareth, and that was the first Division III national championship game that didn't include a Hobart team. Nazareth beat Hobart in the semifinals at Hobart. And then we beat Ithaca in the semifinals and played Nazareth in the 92 championship. And that was also the first time a Division III team was at the Final Four, you know, which is kind of a staple now, right? Everybody goes to, well, a lot of people go to see the D3 game, the D2 game, and the D1 guys. We were the first team to play in that at Franklin Field at Penn. That was exciting. And I've been around so long, right? So I got to see Salisbury rise, and we battled those guys. Some amazing games. We lost to Salisbury by one in 1991. Of course, that was the year that Hobart beat Salisbury. That was actually at Salisbury. And then in 92, we beat Salisbury, the year we went to the championship. And then I got to see the rise of Nazareth, right? We played them. We flew up to Nazareth and played them in the early 90s when they were on their great run. And then we also played Washington College when Coach Haas was there, and they were in three national championship games. We beat them actually in 98, the year that they won the national championship. Also got to play against Coach Pressler when Ohio Wesleyan was a powerhouse. I think there were three or four national championship games. We beat them one year when they were ranked number one. They had that awesome zone defense. And then all the other teams that have come since, of course, Christopher Newport has risen on the scene. We had some great battles with them. York came up on the scene. So I've seen all those teams, and it's wild, right? The ebbs and flows and the great coaching, and I'm just proud that I've been able to coach and play against a lot of those teams and coaches that people might know about. And that doesn't even include our own conference, right? With Washington and Lee, I've seen their progression. Lynchburg, I've seen their progression. Of course, Randolph-Macon is coming on strong in Hampton-Sydney. So I'm just proud that I've seen all that, and quite a history with, like I said, from Hobart, kind of passing the torch to Salisbury, and it's bounced around a little bit. And we've even mixed in with some of those NESCAC teams along the way too, Wesleyan, played them when they won the national championship, stuff like that. It's been fun.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, think about the ODAC conference. That's probably one of the most historic, you know, generationally talented conferences that year in, year out are always talked about. And so you alluded to it a little bit there, but your coaching spans from, you know, the 1980s all the way to the 2020s. Like, that's five different decades that you've been through, which is truly incredible. So what would you say has evolved from that time to now? And what would you say are the benefits and maybe what's not so great about it too, that you've seen change over the years?
Well, the one thing that's definitely not good for coaches like me is there's a lot more great teams now than there ever was. You know, in the early 90s and stuff, there was, I don't know, 15, 20 really good teams, and then the rest were just okay. Now, I mean, you can go down the rankings and see, you know, I had a really good team this year, and we ended up ranked like number 25. And in the old days, you know, we would be number 5 or 7 or something. So I'm just amazed, you know, and you guys know the teams, right? The Grove Cities, there's so Swarthmore, right? There's so many York, so many teams that are now well coached and have great players. There's so many good players. So I think it's harder than ever to be on top. I think that's why the teams that consistently do it really have great coaching and they do an unbelievable job. You know, Tufts is on a great run, and it's amazing to me to stay that high that long. Nowadays, I think it's harder than ever. I think there were great players in all the decades, you know, and the great players back in 1992 could have played now without a doubt. But there's more of them and more good teams, like, you know, on your podcast, more teams to talk about than ever before.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's really well said. And it's one of the things that even, like, you know, even just from our time, like early stages of our playing career to now, you can feel some of that shift. And there's just like so much talent across the entire Division III landscape. And I feel like that in general is a really good segue into a question just kind of specifically about your team. And you mentioned your team this year. And every time I've watched over the last few years, it's been these two guys that kind of steal the show for me, just from, like, I have older brothers and that aspect. But can you talk a little bit about coaching the Cameraman brothers and how cool it is for them to, like, you know, do things like combine for 10 points against Lynchburg in a really big game at, you know, on a big stage?
Yeah, you know, they're great guys. And, you know, I don't know if you knew or not, but their father, James Cameraman, I recruited him, and he played for me back in, he graduated in 94. So he played back in the early 90s for me. He was a guy I recruited out of Connecticut. And then for him to send his one son and then a second son is, I told the team at a banquet towards the end of the year that was one of my proudest moments as a coach, when people would actually send their sons to play for me, you know, because if you're going to send someone you love to play for a coach, you must really believe in that program and the coaching style, et cetera. So having James around again, being at a lot of games, was really fun for me. In fact, I just texted him earlier today, and I said, how are you doing? Because he was taking my retirement harder than I was, so I wanted to make sure he was okay. So I wanted to check in on him. But yeah, they're great guys, and coaching them, tremendous quickness, and just competitors, you know, kind of want to win type guys. They're very different people, you know. Julian's pound for pound one of the toughest guys I've ever coached. And Luke is one of the quickest guys I've ever coached, and very smart. So it's been great. And like you said, there's just a brothers thing. It's cool to have brothers on the same team. If you've ever been on a team like that, especially two at the same end of the field, right? Offense or defense.
Yeah.
You can think what the other guy's doing. And funny quick story. We were playing against Lynchburg. I think it was the regular season game, which was a great 1918, a great D3 game.
Yep.
And Julian yelled at one of our guys on the team. He said something to him, you know, let's do this. And I think he used a curse word or something. So he got a flag. And then Luke came over and started yelling at Julian. And Luke told him to shut the heck up. The ref gave Luke a flag. I'm like, hey, he's talking to his brother. he's not yelling at you.
This is just siblings. There's nothing wrong with that. That should be immediately dismissed.
That's what I thought, but the ref didn't see it that way. So it was kind of funny that Luke, the bigger brother, was trying to help the younger brother, but he yelled at him like he would in his house, I guess. But the ref didn't like
yeah.
it. We only got one penalty, so it wasn't that bad.
Yeah. Well, at least they combined them or some sort of compromise yeah. there. But you mentioned, you know, obviously breaking the news and telling the team and so on and so forth. Like, how did you play all of that out? When did the team find out? When did you tell those guys? Did you give them like a heads up before the ODAC? Like, hey, this is our last ride. Or I know that that's obviously a really tough, you know, situation or way to do it, but just curious how you decided to do
it. Yeah, I wasn't sure this was my last year until as the season wore on and stuff, and I really loved the guys, and I really didn't want to leave them. And as far as telling the team, I talked with my wife a lot about it, and, you know, and I didn't want to give them anything else to think about other than the game, so I didn't want to have, you know, hey, I'm leaving, let's win one for the Gipper-type scenario. So I waited till the games were over, till all the games were done. And then I said, well, I've coached my last game and you guys are my last team, that kind of thing. And I wanted to do it face to face. You know, I was thinking maybe I could let them leave and graduate, you know, have some fun times, but I wanted to see them face to face, which I did. And you know, some of them were kind of shocked. I think some of them kind of thought that day might come, but it came quicker than they thought. Kind of one of those deals. But yeah, it was hard to, I wanted to do what was best for them so they could focus on their season without thinking about me. I didn't want any attention on me for the season. You know, I wanted it on the team. And so I think I achieved that. And it's hard when, you know, you love the guys and, you know, I love the school. And so, and I feel great. I think I was at my top in terms of coaching knowledge and seeing things on the field. I feel stronger than I've ever felt there. So, but I also wanted to leave when I was still good. I didn't want to leave and people say right. I should have done it 6 years ago. I mean, some people might still say that, but hopefully most don't. So I feel good about that.
Well, you coming on here has certainly solidified that we will never say anything like that. So you've got us in your back pocket forever.
I appreciate that.
100%. And hey, coach, if you ever want to get back into it, the Swarm is always looking for some talented coaches. So just throw
I think the last thing that he's going to want to do this summer after 37 summers of recruiting is spend any time anywhere near a club lacrosse field.
No, fair, I'll stay away for a while, but I might take you up in the future. Who knows?
Yeah. You let me know. My phone's always open for you to hit up. good. So coach, you lead Roanoke with 710 saves, which is, you know, insane if you think about that. And then you've also coached six of the other nine who are in the top 10 for goalies at Roanoke. So just a great roster there of goalies that have been through the school with you.
You got any Coach Pilot's goalie camp stuff, big dog?
Oh, dude, of course. I was using all those tools back in the day. 2005 big dog with his, you know, eating his pizza Lunchable, you know, reading some books, getting prepped, all looking at all the Coach Pilot stuff. The mental stuff really helped me out too later in life, but you know, later in my collegiate career and stuff, but no, I was always using the Coach Pilot tools. So they were super helpful. But, to get back there, you've coached so many great goalies. Who are a couple that stick out to you in mind that were some of your favorites to coach and, what made them get that honor there?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Did you come to the goalie school? I think you did. Yes,
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Which one at Roanoke?
Yep.
I thought so. What were you, like eighth grade or something?
You know what? I think it was. Yeah. Yeah, because no, how do you remember that? Wow. I don't even remember that.
I told you I still got it.
He's locked in. He did. You mentioned it.
No, yeah.
No, I appreciate that. The goalie school has been great. I mean, you know, it's so funny. I started over 30 years ago, and I did it because I had a lacrosse camp, you know, like everybody else had. And the first year I had 35 kids at my camp, and that was great. And then the next year I had 65 or something. Then I had 135. So it was growing and we were having a great time. But I kept getting more and more goalies. So I had like 130 campers, but 50 of them were goalies because everybody was sending me their goalies to work with. And this is the early 90s. So I said, well, maybe I should just do a goalie camp. And people said, no, you're crazy. People will never come to that. I said, well, I'll just try it. I don't care. I just have too many goalies. We can't have 10 goalies on every team. So I started this goalie camp in the first year, 55 goalies. And then I expanded to Massachusetts was my first, or Connecticut was my first northern site. And then I'd have 120, then I'd have 200. So I had to do more camps. And I've got to work with so many good goalies, and I really like doing it. I really like coaching the goalies, teaching the guys. I think that's obviously that and face off is two positions. They really need the individual instruction. So I'm going to continue the goalie school, right? It's bigger and stronger than ever. And so that's been really fun. I have California, Oregon, Colorado. I'm all over the place. So I'll be busy with that. But I've coached a lot of great goalies. And one shout out I'll make is to a guy named John Church, who's not on your list of the six of nine or seven, whatever it was. He was a goalie at Washington and Lee. I was assistant there in 1987. I was a goalie coach, defensive coordinator, and assistant coach. And John Church was a goalie who started for 3 years. And he really wanted to be good, and he was like a sponge, and he did everything I said, and we did some unorthodox things. As an example, that year, 1987, at Washington Lee, anytime there was a fast break, we never slid off the two low guys. We just played a two-on-one up top, and that was because John Church was a bigger guy, right, and Big Dog can relate a little bit. He was not good side-to-side, but if he was set, he could save it. So we said, you either got to save it on the left side or one pass to the right side. And anyway, he worked hard, and he ended up being second-team All-American that year from nothing the year before. So I was really proud of him. But he was one of the best I ever had. And at Roanoke, of course, we've always had a great tradition of great goalies, you know, going back to Bill Barroza, who was a great goalie at Roanoke before I got there, and John Nuro, who was Kelly winner before I got there. And then, of course, I was there for 4 years. And the guys I coached, you know, Chris Gordon was a super goalie, second team All-American, battling hard with Washington College back then. Matt Madelon, the Princeton coach, was second team All-American goalie at the time. Awesome, awesome goalie. Steve Mason was a great goalie, All-American for Roanoke back in the early 90s. And then, of course, Ian Davies was more contemporary, was the only goalie I coached a first team All-American. I've had a bunch that were second team that easily could have been first. And Ian Davies was one of the quickest goalies I've ever coached. And there's been many others. So it's just been amazing. Craig Fleming was a 3-time All-American, came from Severn. And Craig Fleming I recruited. He was in the same class and played against in high school Scott Bacigalupo, who everybody knows from Princeton greatness. In some ways, I thought Craig Fleming was a better goalie in high school. So we got Craig Fleming and they got Bacigalupo. And obviously, both had great careers, and Bacigalupo was a legend, and Craig was a great legend for Roanoke as well. So there's been lots of them.
Yeah, love that. That's a great way to put it. And yeah, that second team versus first team thing. I as a 2 second teamer myself, and never able to crack that top thing. It's a tough list to crack. Yeah, so yeah, I mean, anybody that gets on that top spot,
second best. If you were any other position, you're first team All-American.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
We know. We feel you.
All right, Coach. I have a few more here, and obviously, I'm gonna try and pull at some of the more memorable and reminiscent style of questions. But when you think back across the 37, and one of the things that I'll add to the intro to this question is, I think that one of the things that like makes this podcast interesting is the percentage of Division III head coaches or assistant coaches that listen to it compared to like the number of total people that listen to it is a pretty good percentage. So like, what kind of advice would you give to those guys that right now, you know, are trying to get the most out of their teams and just, you know, you've had 37 goes at it to figure out kind of what makes each team unique or what makes the best teams, you know, actually the best teams. What's the secret code?
Well, one thing I'm really proud of over all the years I've had is, you know, we rarely, if ever, had any like controversies in the locker room or disgruntled guys. You know, like I always tell recruits and players, as I've been coaching a long time, but only 10 people can be on the field at one time. So nowadays your rosters are 50. You know, I keep it below 50. I don't like to go over that number, but you know, 50 players, that means 40 are not playing. So you better keep them engaged, you know. And I think I've been able to do that. I take a lot of pride in that. But you know, one of the things we always preach to our team is attitude is number one. You know, and I've heard John Calipari say things like this too, like if you have bad body language, he won't put you in and things like that. So I kind of do the same thing. If you're not practicing hard, I don't care what you tell me you can do on game day, you're not going to get a chance to do it. You know, everyone has to practice hard and everyone has to do the runs, the goalies included, everybody, the faceoff guys. So I think that's a big thing. And I would say what I learned from my dad, who I love and miss every day, is consistency. That's one thing I take a lot of pride in. People might not like what I say, but I'm consistent in what I say. So if you're not giving effort, whether you're a star or someone that never plays, I'm going to say what's going on. We need more effort, or just don't come out here. Things like that. And if you're not dressed in the proper clothing for practice, I'm going to send people back to the locker room. And so consistency, I think, for a young coach, and that's what I've told Will too. So the guys know that they can expect, right? If coach is going to blow up, well, he doesn't just blow up for no reason. Why did he blow up? Oh, we weren't hustling. We didn't know the plays. Whatever the hot buttons are. I think if the guys know that, then first of all, they're going to try to do the right thing. And second of all, they're not going to be surprised when a coach comes down on them. They're going to say, yes, coach told us I needed my playbook at the meeting. I forgot it. So he threw me out. So I think that consistency is something I've stressed in myself. My dad taught me that. And I try to teach that to my coaches too.
And then I'll follow that up. And we did a little bit of homework here at the D3 pod. And we talked to some former players to try and gather some questions. So one of them that we gathered along these lines was that you had a weekly difference. Tell us what that is and what the impact of on the team
That's
was.
That's great. The difference, every Roanoke guy for the last 37 years knows what that is. And I'm trying to write a book called The Difference that I go over some of my favorites and some that I think can help people. So if you have any publishing guys that can help me, let me know off the air. But the difference every day in our practice is a little different than other teams. We practice in four quarters. I started that 37 years ago. So I would say to the guys, okay, guys, first quarter. And first quarter is typically your stretch, your warm up, you know, whatever stick skills you're going to do, maybe some shooting. And at the end of every quarter, we get water. So the guys know there's going to be four times they can get water. So again, consistency. I'll blow the whistle, end of the first quarter. And the guys know that means, okay, go get water. And then second quarter, usually some individual stuff, maybe some two-on-twos or some footwork for the D. Goalies might do some outlets or something. And then at the end of the second quarter, we have halftime. And halftime's a little longer, right? They get water. We go a little slower. And that's where we have the difference. And the difference is basically something that I come up with. It could be a tactical thing. Like one of our differences, we teach the defensemen that if the ball's rolling out of bounds on the defensive side, we never save the ball at Roanoke. I'd rather have you kick it out of bounds than flip it over your shoulder.
Then flip it back
we,
in.
We don't, we don't. If anybody does that at Roanoke, well, I don't know about the future, but in the past, if they did that at Roanoke, people start yelling. So that's like a typical difference. But we also have other differences that are, you know, maybe for confidence, maybe how to walk on the field. Like you want to walk with your head up and looking eyes forward, focused on the task at hand. One difference, you guys would probably appreciate this difference. I have a difference, I call it NFL or college. And I do this one in the fall when the freshmen come in right to the fall ball practice. I say, okay, guys, the difference today is NFL or college. And then I say, guys, in college, you got to make some big decisions. And one is, are you an NFL guy or a college football guy? Because here's the deal. Saturday, right, we have practice in the morning. And then college game day's on. All day you could watch college football. Sunday, NFL comes on all day, you could watch NFL football. You as a college student need to pick which one you are, college or pro, because the other day you got to study. You can't do both. Yeah. So that's an example of a difference.
I love it. I love it. That's fantastic.
Oh, that's a great one.
I knew you guys like that.
Yeah.
I've been guilty of that far too many times. Yeah. And especially, I feel that now as an adult, too. I need to pick if I'm, I need to just pick a sport in general.
Yeah.
Or division.
Yeah. Way too many Saturdays and Sundays have been wasted on just football recently. So that's a good way to put it.
Pick one. And then I tell, for the really smart guys, I'm like, look, you can do both. I'm not going to lie. But you got to pick one college game and one pro game. Then you're okay.
Yeah.
Moderation.
Love that. Another tidbit that we got was the term big fella. As a fellow big fella myself, where does that come from?
Yeah, it's funny. I told my assistant coach, I had two new assistants this year, and I told them about big fella because I called everybody a big fella. I'm like, big fella, come over here. Big fella, what are you doing? And I got big fella from, I grew up in New Jersey, right? I played at Montclair High School, and that was a powerhouse back then when my brothers and I played there. And we had two amazing coaches, Gil Gibbs, who's an awesome coach. He passed away when he was only 35 from cancer, but he won 10 state championships. He was unbelievable. But he had an assistant coach called Mr. Robinson, who was, of course, a phys ed teacher back, you know, in the 70s, like all the old-time coaches were. Mr. Gibbs was a small, skinny, white guy. Mr. Robinson was a big, strong black guy, and they loved each other, and they were complete opposites. Mr. Gibbs was calm and quiet, and Mr. Rob was rough. If you messed with him, you're in big trouble. So Mr. Rob called everybody big fella. So that's, I stole it from Mr. Robinson, who's passed on. I miss him every day. But he would say, hey, big fella, what are you doing there, big fella? So some, I think he didn't remember everybody's name, so he called him that. So it kind of helped me out later in my career when I didn't remember everybody's name, but that's where I got big fella from. I stole it from him.
All right. Another one that we were told that we have to specifically ask about. And one of the questions I have, so hopefully this doesn't bite into that list, is for your top matchups of all time, top games of all time that you can recall. But this one I'm specifically going for is 2007. Against Lynchburg, a Roanoke comeback. What do you remember from that game?
Oh, my God, yeah. I'm telling you right now, fellas, you can look it up. I believe it's the greatest comeback in the history of lacrosse. Any division.
Okay. All right, I'm going to start looking it up.
Any division, because I have printed somewhere. I don't know if I could find it. I might have it up here. The box score. I don't know if it's on Lynchburg's site, but I think we scored, like, I don't know, 6 goals in, like, a minute 30 or something like that. It was insane, because the Lynchburg fans were already singing the Na 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 song to us when we started the comeback.
Where was it? Was it at Roanoke? Or I guess it was at Lynchburg.
It was at Lynchburg, and they were singing the song, the Na 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 song, and it was amazing. We had Billy Cameron, who's now the head coach at Rhodes. He was winning every face-off, so we were coming, and I distinctly remember we were coming back hard because we were down 6 or something like that. And we were about to tie it, and we shot the ball, and it hit the pipe. And as the ball hit the pipe, it was launching in the air. And I was thinking to myself, okay, when this ends, I'm going to tell the guys how proud I am for fighting till the end. Well, our guy caught it and one pass and scored and tied it up. So I didn't have to do that speech. And then in overtime, we went down and scored.
Yep, I found it. So 17-16 overtime on March 31st, and it was trailing by 4 goals with less than a minute.
Trailing by 4. Less than 4 goals.
Usually the rule in lacrosse is a goal a minute. So 4 goals in 4 minutes, 3 goals in 3 minutes, so on and so forth.
4 goals.
So 4 goals in 1 minute is, you might be right. It might be the greatest comeback in the history of lacrosse.
And I think if you look to the goal just before that, it's not that much more time. Like if you see the time on the clock, I think it's even more impressive.
Yep. 36, 25, 16, and 4. So like 9 seconds apart. 4, there.
Right. I think it might be the greatest of all time. And then we capped it off in 1. So, yeah, that was. I've never seen a team sing the song and the fans sing the song and then the team come.
And it come back to haunt it. Yeah, that's brutal.
That's got to be so bittersweet for them.
That was crazy. And after the game, you know, I'm the coach. I'm making sure the team gets back safe and where's the pizza or whatever. Some guy, excuse me, one of our dads grabbed me and he's like shaking me. I've never seen anything like it. He was going off. And then I was like, yeah, that was pretty crazy.
Unbelievable.
That's great. Coach, I got one last question for you here. And it's a little bit of a loaded one, but you've been in this role for 37 years now, lots of teams, lots of players. What do you want your legacy to be at the end of the day when we think of Coach Bill Pilot at Roanoke? What is one or two things that you want anybody to have in mind when they think about that?
I think that I was consistent, you know, that I was fair and consistent, and I gave everybody a chance and told them what I wanted from them, you know, clearly stated what I wanted them to do in order to play and things like that. And the other thing, and this was a goal when I took over as coach at Roanoke, I really wanted the guys that played for me to create lifelong friends and to stick together, right, as they graduated and moved on, families and that. I wanted them to stay in contact with one another, because I thought that was what really would last way more than any game and wins. You know, those things are fun, but those guys sticking together, and I think we've done that because the guys I talk to all talk to. If I want to find out about one person, I just call somebody from that area and ask where he's at or what he's doing, and they can put me in the right direction. So that's what I'm most proud of, that I could keep these guys together. And now we've worked hard to mesh the different generations, right? I know the guys from 91, and I also know the guys from 2001, but now we're starting to introduce those guys to each other, and that's really fun for me to see, for sure.
That's really well put. I know that's something Coach Childs really preaches and tries to get the alumni to get involved with, so that's really good to hear. I appreciate
that.
That's
been real rewarding, and I set that as a goal early on, and I've always tried to stick with that, and you know, I think Coach Childs is really, really wise to be doing that, because that'll last way longer than any wins and losses.
I think he's in year 12 or 13, so he's only got like 24 or 25 years to go.
He'll get there.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Coach. I think Big Dog's question was the perfect one to end on. The only thing, I'll give you another opportunity, if there's anything else that we didn't hit on that you'd like to touch on before we let you go, the floor is absolutely yours. And also, I will say, publicly here, that an open invitation for you to come back on, whether it's book plugging, and we won't even make you bring on a weird girlfriend or anything like that, and just an open invitation whenever you want to come back on, we are glad to have you.
Yeah, I know. 100%. I appreciate that. You guys do a great job. I've listened, you know, the D3 stuff has been great, and you know, D3 doesn't get the recognition it deserves. We have so many guys playing in Division 3, and I know other sports, it's the same, but lacrosse, as we all know, is so much different. And any love we can give D3, and there's so many good teams now. There's so many more good players, you know, out there. But for me, it's been fun, and I'm gonna miss the guys tremendously. And I'm gonna miss the competition. I really, as a coach, enjoyed bringing people in from different programs and meshing together to create a cohesive team that plays together and that plays for each other. That was the main reason I wanted to be a coach, to help people to do those things. So I really enjoyed that, and I'm gonna miss that. But I won't be far away, right, with my camps. I'll be very busy. I still get to teach goalies the position I love, and I really like helping the goalies because I get so many emails back. Coach, you helped me so much with my confidence, and I just made All-State, or we won the championship. I like those emails. It makes me feel good because those poor guys don't get the coaching they need. So if I can help them, I'm happy to do that. But you guys keep doing what you do. You do a great job.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. You taking the time to come on and chat with us tonight.
Happy to be here, guys. Thank you, guys.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast. The source of the sport.